This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The word elite suddenly leaves a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. That word doesn't just refer to upper middle class and rich people. It refers to academics and experts in all fields. It isn't that we're not paying attention to them. It's just that we are refusing to listen or to believe them. Today, people who actually know something are being disregarded because we know better. This can't end well. It's already gotten the attention of a professor of national security affairs at the Naval War College. He will join us later to talk about his fears surrounding what he calls the rise of anti-intellectualism fueled by a cult of ignorance. First, a man with his hands full. Charlotte School of Law is the state's largest law school, at least it was at one point, and the one with the largest problems of any law school in the state. Last year, troubles there began to pile up, one on top of the other. The American Bar Association put the school on probation in the fall, and in December, the Department of Education pulled federal loans for students attending the school. Other behind-the-scenes problems followed, and recently, only 25% of students passed the bar exam on their first try, the worst in the school's history. But Charlotte School of Law is trying to hang on, and the school's fate is now largely in the hands of Scott Broyles. He is a longtime faculty member, a former federal prosecutor, and now the interim dean, and he joins us to fill us in on what's being done to save the school. Welcome back to the program. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Get a little closer to that, if you would. I don't know how to put this, but this is a real mess.
It is.
So let's go back. Knowing what you know, first as a longtime faculty member and as someone who is now running the school, at least academically, how did this happen?
Well, first of all, Mike, I hope the fate of the school is not in my hands. I think it's in the hands of the Department of Education, but we can get into that. When we opened in 2006, we had a very strong faculty and we were having high bar pass rates. Return 2010, for instance, we had an 87% bar pass rate, which was rivaling or if not topping some of the top law schools like Wake and Duke and Carolina. I think what happened at a certain point is I know what happened. The admissions began to drop in terms of the criteria of the
why?
Well, it was a for-profit school, right? And in addition to that, and that, speaks for itself, but in addition to that, the school had, the administrators had an unrealistic, I think, belief in how you could provide additional resources, academic support for students with low indicators coming in, and that would address the problem of the low indicators. And I call that overly optimistic is probably a generous way of
putting it. You've been there since the very beginning, right?
Correct.
And so you started on Moorhead Street with how many students, 35?
About 45, 48. Okay.
And then you moved to Suttle Avenue in a building I thought was built for the school, and you expanded because you had to move because it was too small very quickly. I mean, very quickly. You were in, you were out. Now you're downtown. Was that expansion because, as a for-profit institution, they were just bringing as many people as they could gather into the institution, and they needed the space. That's why they had to move.
Yeah, that's part of it. The school's doing very well in its early years. Charlotte's such an attractive place to come that there were a lot of students coming, but they were also lowering the standards.
So was nobody paying any attention, or were they only paying attention to the bottom line?
No, they weren't only paying attention to the bottom line. They were paying close attention to the bottom line, but again, I think they were of the belief that if you add all these additional resources in academic support terms, that could address those lower indicators. That turned out to be not the case, but the faculty was pushing back against that on a consistent basis, but they were not sufficiently listened to.
In your mind, what's the worst thing that has happened, the most important thing? What's the worst that's happened? What's the most important thing that the school needs to do to make things right?
Well, in terms of survival, we're waiting on the Department of Education to restore the funding, the student loans, Title IV funds. We've already addressed the problems that the ABA pointed out to us when they put us on probation. In terms, we've raised the entrance indicators of the students coming in considerably. And to a point, I think they'll appreciate that. We submitted what they call a reliable plan. The faculty remains strong. They've always been recognized. In 2014 site visit, the ABA praised the faculty.
But it's been reduced in size considerably.
It has been reduced in size because of the student
enrollment
body.
Is down.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So it's a chance. It's a matter of survival. We're in a position where we can become the school we once were, a strong academic school, and reaching out to certain underprivileged folks.
So what's the worst that's happened in your point of view as a faculty member or as somebody who understands what students need to get out of that experience?
The worst in terms of the school's survival or the worst decisions made?
Your choice.
Well, the worst thing that happened in terms of school decision-making was this misguided belief that you can bring in these students with low indicators. That was the primary mistake the administration made. The worst thing that's happened to the school was the denial or the taking away of Title IV funds.
So now let's talk about these entrance indicators because I understand what you're talking about. What are those indicators?
They are the LSAT, the Law School Aptitude Test scores, mm-hmm. and the undergraduate grade point
And what
average.
Does that test look for, the LSAT?
Well, it's been a long time since I took it, but it looks for critical reasoning, the ability to read and understand quickly, logic, analysis, and things of that nature.
And as I understand it, one of the things Charlotte School of Law has traditionally done is gone after people who are not candidates necessarily for more traditional or more established law schools and tried to offer them an opportunity
Correct.
To become a lawyer and,
Right.
and improve their station in life. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. And
how do you do that if you don't look the other way on some of these indicators to give them a shot at getting in the door?
That's the problem, isn't it? Trying to find those people with the lower indicators but still have the ability to succeed at law school. And a number of different things were tried. And ultimately not particularly successful, as we know.
Are others – this is – you're run by a company called, I think, InfoLaw.
Correct.
And you have – they have several law schools, Florida, Arizona, here, et cetera. Are these problems rampant through their organization, through the other schools, or is this particular to Charlotte and the Charlotte School of Law?
There – those problems – the admissions problems are also at the other two schools, Arizona and Florida. Florida's doing the best. They're stronger than the others, but Arizona and Charlotte are – we've had the lowest
– Have they been looked at by the ABA and by the federal government?
They have.
And what's the situation at those schools?
Arizona was put on probation, I believe, last week. Florida Coastal is not on probation.
What does that say about the operational organization?
It says what I was talking about earlier, that there was a misguided belief that you could reach down into these lower – well, we're talking about indicators and provide these additional resources and have them succeed in law school. Mm-hmm. And again, the faculty pushed back against that, but they were not attended.
We've seen a couple of many for-profit schools go out of business, and we've also seen examples of for-profit schools, including some in Charlotte, who – and I don't know whether to ascribe motive to this or not, but it appears from the outside that the motivating factor on all of it was simply bringing as many people in as possible, getting federal money for these students – and letting people that they knew probably wouldn't finish the course in because they got to keep the money. Is what's happening here an example of that?
Difficult to say. I'm not going to say that's not part of the answer, because I think it's part of the answer. Again, I think, you know, people are mixed motives, right? And it's tough to look into a person's heart and mind, but I do think the desire for profit, in addition to this belief that they did supply all these additional resources above and beyond what other schools were doing.
For instance?
Well, we had very strong academic support. So these are not just professors, but people who are very capable of teaching, and we had a whole department, and we still do, of these academic support and bar prep peoples and very rigorous academic support.
But it
classes.
Doesn't seem to be working
because
your law school, what's the word? The bar exam rate has been
right.
falling precipitously for quite a while now.
Correct.
Why isn't it working?
It's working because the students.
Why isn't it working?
Why isn't it working?
Yeah.
because these students, regardless, many of them, regardless of how many resources you provide, are simply not able to handle law school.
Are they unprepared academically? Are they unprepared in terms of not knowing how to study? Are they unprepared because they really don't have a clue as to what goes into becoming a lawyer and what you have to do to get to the point where you can pass the bar? Are all of those things operating there?
Those are all factors.
Are they not, when you interview an incoming student or a prospective incoming student, do you walk them through what the expectations are and how it works and how you study? And if you've had a tough time academically up to this point, here's what you have to do to change that. Do you walk them through that?
That is part of the process. They are walked through those. I've never been in the admissions team, and I've never been part of that. But that they do those sorts of things. But again, when you're dealing with a certain level that you can't go below, and that happened.
When the American Bar Association put the school on probation in the fall of last year, first of all, what does that mean? And secondly, did it come as a surprise to anybody on the faculty, anybody on the staff, to the students themselves?
Probably to the students. The most of the faculty, I think, were not surprised, and many of us, myself certainly, think that the ABA did the right thing by putting us on probation because improvements needed to be made, the kinds we've been talking about. And so I think the ABA was spot on.
There was that tape that we aired that was recorded on somebody's phone in a meeting with a former administrator at the Charlotte School of Law that was laced with profanities, which were bleeped, obviously, for air, but which indicated a great deal of pressure. It was like being in a boiler room sales outfit where you have to make a certain number of closes on the deal or you were gone. That's what it sounded like. Is that what it felt like to be on the other side of that, that the faculty was under a lot of pressure?
Well, there's a difference in the people that are trying. Those were I have not listened to that tape.
It's
but
like,
she was
it's
part
like
of
listening
the,
to the script of Glengarry Glen Ross. By
oh boy! Well, I'm not going
David
to listen
Mamet.
To it. Right. The pressure she was under was to get these students to pass the bar. The pressure, the faculty. We were not pressured in that sense. The pressure we felt was that we were dealing with students that we could not properly teach, put it simply.
But it sounded like in the stories that surrounded the release of that tape and the conversations that some of our reporters had with some of the faculty on and off the record, it sounded like you guys were on you were on the side of the student, but you were on the side of doing the right thing and that many people felt frustrated by the fact the school wasn't doing the right thing. Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
So when you point the finger of blame, do you point it at your predecessor? Do you point it at InfoLaw in Florida? Who do you point the finger at?
I don't like to point fingers of blame, right? But it was the administration who made the decision to bring in students who were not capable of performing
and they're
at the law
gone?
School level. I replaced the former dean, and because of all this, that's why the faculty voted the former dean down and voted me in.
Is he still there?
He's still there as a faculty member.
How do you explain his approach versus your approach?
My approach is very common sense, you know, that the common sense recognition that certain students shouldn't be in law school. His approach, I think, is more based in social science analytics. But, you know, when you're in the classroom and you're teaching these kids and you see that many of them are not capable of succeeding, it is very frustrating. And that's why we pushed back hard.
And when you see somebody who's there and shouldn't be there because they have no chance of becoming a lawyer ultimately, and if they do become a lawyer, it lowers the reputation of the school and therefore no one will hire them. Do you counsel them that perhaps this is not a good thing to spend your time doing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's your moral and ethical responsibility to say.
Scott Broyles is our guest. He is the interim dean of the Charlotte School of Law, trying to right the ship here, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFA. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Alan Cummings Sings Sappy Songs. This host of PBS's Masterpiece Mystery combines actor and activist into a countercultural performance April 30th in the Belk Theater. Tickets at 704-372-1000. and Queen's Cup Steeplechase, hosting the 22nd annual Steeplechase races. Saturday, April 29th, minutes from I-485 Beltway. Experience the thrill of the chase. Tailgating packages and tickets available at queenscup.org. On the local news roundup, the NCAA reluctantly agrees to consider bringing games back to North Carolina with the repeal of HB2. The homicide rate in Charlotte continues to rise, 27 so far this year. The Charlotte mayor's race has seen some movement in terms of fundraising, and the Tar Heels win it all, bringing basketball glory back to the state. Our roundtable of reporters set to talk about those stories and more tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Asbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the gas attacks in Syria and the U.S. threat in the U.N. to act. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Stay tuned for that conversation on Point following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Scott Broyles is with us. He's the interim dean of the Charlotte School of Law. It has been no secret that they have had some troubles in the last year. Last fall, the ABA put them on probation, and then shortly thereafter, the federal government, the Department of Education, pulled the funding for student loans. That left a lot of students in the lurch because they couldn't continue their education without those loans. Many were toward the end of their law school careers but didn't have the money necessarily to continue. Has that been addressed? Have those students who lost their funding through no fault of their own been addressed?
Some of them, not all of them. Many are suffering greatly just to pay rent. The school has reached out to some extent to help, and there's a limit to what they can do. Finances are tight. So things are very difficult for the students right now, and absent a decision from the DOE in the near future, very near future, they're only going to get worse. Mm.
Any chances that this student funding will be restored?
I'm optimistic that it'll be restored, but the more the delay, the more likely we can.
Are you optimistic because of what the school is doing to correct the situation, or because there's been a change in administrations in Washington and the new Department of Education may take a completely different point of view on all of this?
Both.
Because Betsy DeVos comes from an atmosphere or a background of running for-profit schools.
You've identified exactly the situation. We have taken the corrective steps that the ABA required of us, and that's what probation is all about. You're put on probation, you do the right thing. And also you identify the other problem. The prior administration took away Title IV funding. That has never been done before. ABA put you on probation. You correct your behavior. Mm-hmm. But in this case, they didn't allow us to correct our behavior, which we had done, and we had put in plans in place. They simply took away funding.
So you're saying that the previous administration did the wrong thing.
Absolutely, they did the wrong thing. 6 days before Christmas, they took away the students' money, basically, and they did not recognize that we were taking the steps to get back to where we were pursuant to ABA directives.
So surely conversations were held with the former Secretary of Education in the Obama administration by somebody at your organization. Were you privy to those conversations? Did you know what they said back and forth?
I was not privy to the conversations. I was on the faculty.
Shortly after the announcement that the school was going to lose its funding for student loans because of the decision of the Department of Education, it was discovered by outsiders that the school had a program in which they actively discouraged some students from taking the bar. They were encouraged to delay taking the bar because bar exam test scores had not been terribly good, and the school was even offering a stipend to some students to tide them over until they could get themselves to the point where they felt they could succeed at taking the bar. How unusual is that?
I don't know. That's a good question. I know they believed that some of the students weren't ready and they wanted them to have a greater opportunity to prepare. How much of that is done across the country? I have no idea.
Is it ethical?
It's ethical to the extent that they were telling the students more preparation is needed, mm-hmm. because then you have a greater chance of passing the bar. Any other motives that were going on, I wasn't privy to, but if there were other motives, that's a problem.
Is it legal?
Is it legal?
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know.
Pay your students not to essentially graduate.
Well, I would say to pay your students to delay
right
till you're prepared to take the bar.
And was there a program concurrent with that to prepare them?
There was. There was. Additional instruction were provided.
Was that free or was that?
You know, that, I think if it wasn't free, I know I'm pretty sure it was at a significantly reduced price.
Is that program still in place?
I don't think so. And as long as I'm dean, that would be used only when it was absolutely to the benefit
so?
Of the student.
You don't think so?
I don't think so. Now, look, I've been in here for 2.5 weeks, right? I've been in this position for 2.5 weeks. Have I seen everything that's still going on? No.
All right.
But it's not going to happen under my watch.
Bar exam scores have been woefully low. Last year, only 34.7 passed the exam on their first try. This year, the number was 25%. And I'm told it isn't unusual, actually, for some folks to have trouble passing the bar on their first attempt. Is that true? It's not unusual? A lot of people have to go back a second time?
A lot do. And remember, the February bar is a much smaller number of takers, and the first-time pass rate across the state was unusually low. Ours was lower than the average, but across the state it was only 44%, I believe.
Yeah, 44.4%. That Business Journal reported the average pass rate in North Carolina at large was 44.4%, and that was down from 51.1%. How do you explain that? All over the state, bar exam pass scores are dropping.
I think it's pretty straightforward that the North Carolina bar folk have decided to make it quite a bit tougher for a myriad of reasons.
So how do your numbers compare to the state? Well, we just compared them to the states. They're lower than the states. How do the states' numbers compare to the countries? Do we know?
I haven't looked at that, but I would say that they're lower.
So there's a plan now afoot to keep the Charlotte School of Law open and operational and graduating students until 2019. That it makes it so the current crop of students can graduate. How will you do that?
Now that's only if the school closes. We plan on staying open into the future. That's called the teach-out plan.
Okay.
If it closes, we have to teach out the students that are still in the school.
And how will that be done? How will that be accomplished?
We had to submit a teach-out plan to the ABA, which is under consideration by the ABA, and you work in conjunction with another school to make sure the academics are up to par, which they are.
But you're planning to continue on forever.
Nothing's forever,
right? Nothing's forever, but for as long as – into the foreseeable future.
As long as we're a responsible school that teaches its students well.
You're the interim dean.
Correct.
Do you want the job?
Whew, it's been 2.5 weeks. It's been a pretty tough time. I want the job as long as I can help the school get back to where it needs to be, a responsible, sound academic institution.
There's also the possibility, I understand, that the school will drop its for-profit status and go nonprofit.
Correct.
That plan, if I understand this correctly, would have your parent company, Infolaw, run the business aspect of the school while some other institution will take over supervision of the academic aspect.
Correct.
Is that a workable plan? How unusual is that plan? And is there going to be a firewall between the business side and the academic side?
Yes, it's very workable. It can be done in conjunction with another school or it can be done on its own, but we are pursuing and will be a nonprofit institution. And there already is in place a firewall, and that is the faculty veto that I mentioned earlier that we just passed as a faculty yesterday.
So that was not in place during all the stuff that led up to this point.
Correct.
Why wasn't that in place? Is that a normal thing to have a faculty veto over certain policies and procedures?
I don't believe so.
It's not normal.
No, but most schools have greater faculty governance over admissions, and that's what we've addressed.
Okay. Are you optimistic that despite the lack of student loan funds, even though they may be restored, despite a significantly reduced staff, that you will not only be able to stay open and let the current students graduate, which there's a plan for, but that you'll be able to supply them with an education consistent to what the legal profession would deem as somebody who's hireable once they're out of school?
Well, we already have in place a plan and a system in conjunction with the faculty veto that returns it to very responsible academic credentials. The faculty has always been extremely strong. President O'Ginney is on board completely, and it's locked in. The system is locked in to be a very strong academic school as it once was. But optimism And when the decision is in somebody else's hands, it's difficult when DOE hasn't moved. I think they want to help us, but it's as the clock ticks, so do our chances.
Scott Broyles is the interim dean of the Charlotte School of Law. You have your hands full. Good luck to you.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate it.
You bet.
Well, the Founding Fathers had a healthy fear of democracy. They feared the mentality of the mob. But democracy caught on politically, and then it spread, thanks to technology, to almost every field of endeavor. Technology has allowed almost everyone and anyone to let their opinion be known, to the point where almost every opinion is equally valid, never mind whether or not those opinions are based in fact. In fact, facts be damned. We're living in the world of alternative facts. Today, we seem to be turning our backs on the elites, leaders, and experts in almost all fields, people who really know what they're talking about, preferring our own opinions to theirs. And clearly, this cannot end well. This troubling trend has caught the attention of Tom Nichols. He's a professor of national security affairs at the National Security Decision-Making Department at the Naval War College. He's also got a very long resume, including many posts dealing with strategy and policy. In short, he's one of those experts that many are choosing not to listen to. We hope you listen for the remainder of the hour because he's with us now, but you might also want to check out his book on this topic, The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge, and Why It Matters. Tom Nichols, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. When did you first notice this alarming trend?
Well, actually, as soon as I entered my professional career, probably about 30 years ago, but in a lesser, less strenuous form. As I say in the book, you know, it's normal for people to say, "Oh, you work in foreign policy. You know, I have some opinions about that. I want to talk to you about it." Because, you know, especially during the Cold War, where we were all under the threat of dying at any moment, people wanted to have their voices heard, and it was understandable. But what's changed over the past few years, and the first version of this that I wrote was probably about three or four years ago, is that people not only want to talk to experts or argue with them or speak to them, but do so while claiming that they now know more than experts themselves.
And why is that? Because I don't think this is a debatable topic. I think this is a fact. I think everybody knows it's a fact. And if they don't, they're deluding themselves. So why is that?
Well, I think there are several reasons, and the one word that I use at the very root of this in the book is narcissism. I think America is, and actually the developed Western nations are in the grip of an increasing epidemic of narcissism that's been going on for quite a while. Now, there are other things that enable this, and in the book I talk about the nature of the modern university, the segmentation of the media into little echo chambers, and of course, the elephant in the room, the internet.
Right.
But I think all of it derives from a kind of therapeutic culture where people's feelings are always assumed to be more important than, as you just said, facts. I can give you an example. When I challenged somebody on this notion that, as the president once pointed out, that, you know, unemployment is 42%. I said, well, look, we can disagree about what it is, but it's not 42%. And the answer I got was, but what if I feel it is? And I said, well, you can feel that gravity is 1/6 of what it used to be, but it's still gravity.
Let me go back to something you just said a second ago, because we're going to talk a lot about the internet and social media and the rise of that. And I don't think anybody would argue with that, or not very many people would. Everybody will argue with you. Okay, let's just leave it at that, but maybe not everybody. Let's go back to what you said about the nature of the modern university. What does that mean? I've never heard anybody bring that up before.
Well, I call it client servicing. College, even in my time, and, you know, we're talking within the past 30, 40 years, was supposed to be uncomfortable, at least intellectually uncomfortable. Colleges have always wanted to show you that they have great dorms and nice quads and things like that. But that intellectually, college was supposed to be a place that changes you, that challenges you, that makes you think harder about all the things that you were sure of when you were 16 years old. Instead, the modern university has become a client servicing organization that is there to make sure that you are happy with your grades, that there are enough extracurriculars to keep you busy, that the workload isn't too difficult. And while we could have a whole separate discussion about whether that makes college worth it, that's a different matter. What it does is produce a citizen who believes that he or she is educated, but in fact, they really have not developed critical thinking or the habits of mind or even the foundational knowledge that make them capable of talking with or recognizing expertise when they encounter it.
Well, let's talk about that, because it is generally recognized that Americans have never been better educated than they are today. You're saying that's not necessarily true.
Right. That the wide availability of education or something called education does not translate into being better educated. One of the problems is that, at least at a certain level, colleges, and of course I point out in the book that even the smallest colleges are now trying to rebrand themselves as universities, which is failing, in my view, a truth in advertising problem. But colleges are basically replacing a lot of what high school once was. And so when people say, I went to college, what they really mean is I did a few more years of high school or post, kind of a transitional post-secondary education. They're not really university graduates, despite what it says on their newly reprinted diploma.
So when we have this plethora of people who went through colleges, four-year colleges and universities, with this diploma on the wall, they haven't really learned enough. And does that explain why we have grown suspicious of science and distrustful of experts and disrespectful of almost all authority figures, because our opinion is equally valid? Our beliefs are equally valid to theirs. Is that why? Because we don't know anything?
Well, and because we have the illusion of having learned things. When someone says, well, look, my view on this should be dispositive, you know, I went to a university, Americans can now answer, well, who didn't? So did I. So did everybody. So did the kid down the street. But in fact, they have not all received an equal education. And that is only the part of the cohort of Americans who've actually gone to a university. The rest of Americans, I think, understandably look at some of these educational programs and say, these people are no smarter than I am. And in some cases, they may be right.
Well, you wrote an article about this, which is a shortened version, I guess, of your book, in the Daily Beast, and you begin by quoting Isaac Asimov, who once said there is a cult of ignorance in the United States, and there always has been. First of all, a cult, and secondly, always? Really?
Well, far be it from me to take issue with the late Dr. Asimov. I think Asimov may have put that a little strongly, but I think he's onto something. And yes, always. Tocqueville writes about it. Richard Hofstadter wrote about it 60 years ago, where there is just a kind of a hardcore, and let me say, this is also partly what made America great, is the notion that the common person has this great reserve of common sense. And that we don't need, unlike, you know, old Europe and the cultures we left behind, we don't need highly stratified intellectual elites to tell us how to run our lives every day. The problem is modern life and the size of the world, in a way, have become so complex that we, in fact, do need experts. And as Hofstadter points out, people resent experts precisely because they now know how much they rely on them.
When we come back from the break, I want to pursue something else with you, and that is the fact that a lot of people, particularly in this last election cycle, pointed to so-called experts and said, look, they've screwed everything up. They haven't done such a great job, so let's try something different. And we'll talk about that with Dr. Thomas Nichols when we come back. He's the author of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Cravata Photography, photographing people for business, whatever the business may be. Learn more at CRAVOTTA.com. And Central Piedmont Community College's Ballantyne Center, offering continuing education courses to help professionals earn high-demand job credentials. Details at cpcc.edu/Ballantyne. President Trump says many, many lines were crossed in this week's chemical attack in Syria, which the U.S. and allies say was carried out by the Assad regime. America's U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley says the U.S. could take unilateral action against Syria if the U.N. Security Council fails to take action. And they'll be talking about all of this with Tom Ashbrook on Point coming up in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. We will continue our conversation about the death of expertise in a moment.
Venture capitalists just love pouring money into New York and San Francisco startups. The rest of the country, yeah, not so fast.
For those metros who don't already have the ecosystem that kind of nurtures and attracts venture capital, it's hard to compete with the Silicon Valley.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Venture Capital's geographic diversity issue, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Thomas Nichols is our guest. He's a professor and course director for Security, Strategy, and Forces, National Security Affairs at the Naval War College. And his book is called The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. And during this last election cycle, we had a lot of voters who were saying, and perhaps with some justification, that for years now we've depended on experts to guide us, to tell us what we should and shouldn't do, and they have screwed it up. The world is a mess, so let's try something different. Why are they wrong?
Well, I take issue with the idea that the world is a mess. Whenever I get that argument, I push back. Now, there's a whole chapter in the book about when experts are wrong and how experts can be wrong, including everything that, you know, people worry about, like fraud and malfeasance and all the things that we live in a fallen world. Bad human beings can do bad things. But this notion that the world is completely screwed up because of experts, I first take issue with how screwed up the world really is.
The president said it yesterday.
That I point out, and this doesn't exactly make me popular sometimes, is that in this past election cycle, and I should point out, by the way, I don't represent the Navy or the government. In this past election cycle, I think what's happened is a lot of scapegoating of experts for a lot of really bad decisions that the public itself has sometimes made about finances, about loans, about housing, about and about things that nobody can control, about looking for somebody to blame because of the structural changes in the economy and some of the painful things that experts simply can't prevent from happening. But we look around at the standard of living and the fact that there is, by contemporary standards, a relatively peaceful globe, and it's a pretty remarkable achievement, I would think.
How much of this you mentioned narcissism, but how much of this is also due to the fact that as Americans, we live in the richest nation in the history of the world. Our lives, by any standard, are comfortable for most people. Not everybody is comfortable.
Right. But live longer and healthier.
Exactly. And we have short memories and great expectations. And are we fat, dumb, and happy? Are we lazy?
Well, that last part of it is a big problem because one of the baleful influences of the internet is that people continually measure their lives against an ideal. It's sometimes called the Facebook effect or the home and garden TV effect, that people really do spend a lot of time having expectations of the economy, of experts, of foreign policy that are almost impossible to reach. This is part of the problem that experts are often asked questions. I've talked to audiences several times over the past few months where I've put things out there where I've said, look, you're asking experts to square the circle every day. And some of the things you're asking them to do are simply not possible. When you tell people that you cannot end income inequality next month, that you cannot cure terrorism either by ignoring it or by military force, all of the things experts deal in nuance. And also we're the people that tell one of the things that I think leads to these kinds of charges that you talked about. We're the people who tell you things you don't want to hear because that's our job.
Yeah. Well, people deny science now. People deny the science behind, not all, but some people deny the science behind vaccinations. People took issue with whether or not HIV really causes AIDS. Some question the veracity of the moon landing. And while it isn't true, politicians still say the jury is out among scientists about global warming. I mean, why don't we want to believe these things? Some of these denials sound like people standing up in the middle of a room saying, the world is flat. We wouldn't put up with that.
Well, we've even had people saying the world is flat recently. I mean, you know, it's almost like there's nothing that's so ridiculous that someone hasn't said it in the past few years. I think some of it is, obviously, it's the insanely partisan world we live in now. No one wants to accept, I think a lot of people actually accept science, but they don't want to give an inch because they're always worried that they're giving ground to a political opponent. And I think that runs a lot of the climate change debate, for example. But I think for the average citizen, one of the reasons they push back against science is because they find it personally very empowering to do so. It's empowering to say, I'm not going to vaccinate my children just because some doctor said so. I'm going to believe that GMOs, I'm going to read every label in a supermarket and avoid GMOs because, you know, that is a way of expressing my autonomy in this otherwise big, confusing supermarket. And I think it's become an almost childlike, I said recently that the reaction against experts is almost like a group of Americans saying, you're not the boss of me.
Yeah. It's kind of like a 5-year-old or a teenager.
Yeah, I mean, America, we really have become kind of surly. Well, of course, narcissism is one of the traits of being a surly teenager, but you're supposed to grow out of it, and you're supposed to develop a better capacity for critical thinking beyond simply arguing with authority simply because they're authorities. And again, experts are not the deciders. We're the advisors. And I think people confuse us with their elected representatives who actually do make the decisions. And so the whole thing gets wrapped up in a kind of generic pushback against everybody that you think is potentially controlling or messing up your life.
What also troubles you is not just the ignoring of facts or turning our backs on people who know things. It is the fact that you say you can no longer have a reasoned argument on just about any topic with anyone. Everything devolves into a shouting match. Really, has it gotten that bad?
Well, as I put it in the book, it's that even if it's not a shouting match, conversations are now exhausting because people, it's partly, again, because of the very divided nature of our society, but it's also because people no longer are educated enough or self-educated enough to understand how to structure even a basic argument, that they don't accept basic rules of argument or evidence. Everybody works on motivated, and I shouldn't say everybody, but I think most people work on motivated reasoning and confirmation bias, where my evidence is evidence, your evidence is anecdotal. Mm-hmm. Everything I believe is an ironclad fact. Everything you believe is fake news.
Right.
That makes conversation impossible.
I mean, you use as an example something that's been going on television for quite a while. Jay Leno used to do this. Jimmy Fallon does this. He goes out on the street with a microphone and asks people questions that aren't really that difficult. And as a matter of fact, we had a local reporter here years ago on WBTV, David Rue, who went to a shopping mall and asked people, what body of water borders North Carolina?
Oh, no.
And some of them could not answer the question.
Oh, dear.
So, I mean, it's shocking, and you bring this up. The Washington Post polled Americans about whether the U.S. should engage in military intervention in the wake of the 2014 Russian invasion of Ukraine. Fewer than 25% of college graduates could point to the Ukraine on the map. But respondents showed enthusiasm for military intervention there in direct proportion to their lack of knowledge about Ukraine. That sounds insane to me.
Well, what it really says is that knowledge is a moderating influence on crazy ideas. The 2014 Ukraine example, one that I found deeply disturbing, what that really says is Americans think it's fine to intervene militarily if they think it's in Antarctica. But when you tell them that, no, it's right on the border with Russia and that this could lead to World War III, that little added bit of knowledge makes people say, oh, dear, maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe we ought to think about this twice. What's striking, and I think one of the things that makes policy and discussion with experts and discussion between citizens so frustrating, is that those moments like that show that the people who know the least about something tend to have the strongest opinions about it. Which is a double-barreled problem. Not only do people not know things, but their intensity about an issue seems to vary directly into with how little they know about it.
And that naivete, it seems to me, can get us and has gotten us into a great deal of trouble, because the world is complex. It is not an easy thing. And if you don't have all the information at your fingertips, I mean, you can't possibly know as an American citizen what the President of the United States knows, or what the general, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff know. You can't possibly know all that. So to us, we're sitting out here going, if I were there, I'd just do that and be done.
Right.
And that's not possible, right?
They oughta is a phrase that, you know, goes back a lot longer than this current problem of death of expertise. I mean, we've all been around the table when, you know, the expansive uncle or the very bright, you know, cousin just home from college says, you know what they ought to do?
Mm-hmm.
And, well, you know, they is us. We're the voters. We're the public. We live in a republic. We elect people to represent us and to make these decisions. And one of the foundational arguments I make in the book is that if we really do just reject expertise and we don't gain that foundational knowledge, then we are no longer effective participants in our own system of government.
You can't run a democratic republic this way, can you? Not for very long.
No, not for very long, exactly, because it will decay into one of two forms of autocracy. Either you'll get a populist mob, which historically never lasts very long, or even more worrisome, and I say this as an expert, you could get some kind of technocracy where the experts simply say, well, you know, somebody's got to keep the lights on and keep the water running and the streets paved, and so we'll just not ask any more questions of the public because they don't understand it and they don't want to be bothered. And I think we've come perilously close to that, and I think Americans are abdicating their responsibility to participate in their own governance because they simply don't know enough when they go into the voting booth.
You also say something that is troubling and also difficult to square with the ideals upon which we were established, because Thomas Jefferson wrote, all men are created equal, and we have taken that to heart. And you say that we have developed into a culture that cannot endure even the slightest hint of inequality of any kind. But the truth is, we aren't all created equal in terms of our abilities. And once life gets a hold of us, not all of us achieve equal stature of expertise.
Right.
Now, earlier generations seem to have understood that. Maybe they didn't, but it seems that way. It seems evident on the face of things. So why have we lost sight of that? Not everybody is equal. There are people smarter than me. There are people richer than me.
I think that the earlier generations did understand what Jefferson meant, which is that all men are created equal in the eyes of their creator and before the law. That is our democratic system of government, that democracy, as we practice it in the United States, means equality before the law and equal rights in the eyes of the government. And it took us a long time to get there. It took us constitutional amendments. It took us a civil war that killed hundreds of thousands of our people. But we always understood at the foundation that the Declaration of Independence was about the political equality of human beings, not their actual equality. And somewhere after World War II, we lost our way here, that we started to believe, as the great C.S. Lewis wrote in the early 50s, that somehow we got it into our heads that democracy means I'm as good as you in everything. And that's simply wrong. And in fact, we never ran our country that way. We always tried to find people who we thought were more capable than the rest of us in order to take over the affairs of state, or to advise us on, you know, how to get to the moon or cure cancer or whatever it is that we're doing. And instead, we find, and I think this now stretches back to probably the early 90s is where I usually located it, and maybe even further back, is that what you have people saying, well, I like this politician. He talks like me. He cares about me.
I'd like to have a beer with him.
Yeah, I'd like to have a beer with him. You know, truthfully, there are a lot of people I've encountered, and I've worked in all three levels of government, local, state, and federal, and there are a lot of really very capable people I've met in government that I would not want to spend 5 minutes having a beer with. That is really... the least relevant test of confidence I've ever encountered.
So how do we change this? I mean, we're in the middle of this thing where all of us think we're educated. We're all a mile wide and a millimeter deep in our knowledge of most things that matter, because we get our news out of sound bites and we don't read a lot anymore. Most people don't read a lot. They just hear what they watch the television news, and that's where they get their information. How do we change this? How do we return to a time of respect and trust and the understanding that not everyone is an expert on everything, and that those who are maybe we should listen to them?
Unfortunately, and this is where I keep trying and failing to be more optimistic. I mean, I wrote the book in part to spark this argument so that we're at least having this discussion. But unfortunately, I think that the historical record is that people will turn back to experts after some terrible crisis. For example, you mentioned vaccines earlier. You know, the anti-vaccination movement is really the product of an affluent, healthy society. The lowest vaccination rates tend to be in very affluent suburbs. Poor mothers have no choice. They have to vaccinate their kids to send them to school. That movement has tended to gain ground among kind of semi or moderately educated suburbanites in places like San Francisco. Well, the thing that's going to put a stop to that is not argumentation or doctors coming forward and trying to make rational appeals to this. The thing that will put a stop to it is a pandemic. The first time that something like whooping cough really cuts through one of these communities, people are going to understand vaccines. You know, I'm of a certain age. I happily took the polio vaccine because I actually had people in my family who had right. polio. You know, there was visible evidence of what happens when things like polio get loose. The problem is, in a lot of communities, no one's ever seen any disease like this, and so I worry about a war. I mean, a really major war, not a war fought, you know, far from America's shores by brave volunteers. A real depression, not like the 2008 bailout, but something that really plunges America into serious economic straits. Something like that, where people are going to turn to experts as they.
And with that, I have to stop because we're out of time. Dr. Thomas Nichols is a professor at the Naval War College and the author of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. I hope you can come back. We'll have a further conversation about this.